You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Manifestations of Karma. This is lecture 5, which is entitled Karma in Relation to Natural and Accidental Illness, given in Hamburg on the 20th of May, 1910. What I said in yesterday's lecture is of fundamental importance to what we are going to deal with today. Therefore, I would like to recapitulate the main points. We began by saying that views concerning cures and medicines have, in the course of a relatively short time, during the last century, undergone a radical change. And we pointed to the fact that in the 16th and 17th centuries, that view was developed, which was based entirely upon the theory that for every illness which was given a name, at which it was believed could be strictly defined, some remedy must exist upon earth. And it was firmly believed that by the use of the remedy in question, the course of the illness must be influenced. We then pointed out that this view prevailed more or less until the 19th century, and side by side with this, we showed the complete reversal of this opinion, which found expression chiefly in the nihilism of the Viennese school, founded by the famous physician Dietl and carried on by Skoda and some of his pupils. We characterized the nihilistic current of thought by saying that it not merely harbored doubts as to the existence of any absolute connection between one remedy or another, one manipulation or another, in respect to the treatment of illness and the illness itself, but would no longer concern itself with any such connection. The idea of so-called, quote, self-healing, close quote, penetrated the minds of the young doctors influenced by this school. Skoda himself made the following significant statement to this school, quote, "We may be able to diagnose an illness, to explain and perhaps also to describe it, but remedy for it, we have none," close quote. This point of view originated from the proofs furnished by Dietl to the effect that, given the necessary conditions, an illness such as pneumonia will, with temporizing treatment, take such a course as to develop self-healing forces at the end of a certain period. By means of statistics, he was able to prove that a temporizing treatment showed neither fewer cures, nor more deaths than the remedies ordinarily in use. At that time, the term therapeutic nihilism was not without justification, for it is quite true that the doctors of this school were powerless against the patient's conviction that there simply must exist a remedy, a prescription. The patient would not yield, nor would his friends. A remedy had to be prescribed, and the followers of this school got out of the difficulty by prescribing a thin solution of gum arabic, which, according to their opinion, would have the same effect as the remedies previously in use. From this we have learned how the modern scientific world is moving in the direction of what one might call the karmic connections of life. For now they had to find an answer to the question, quote, how is that which we may call self-healing brought about? Or better, why does it take place? And why, in some cases, can there be no self-healing or cure of any kind? Close quote. The fact that an entire school, led by eminent authorities in the field of medicine, thought of introducing the concept of self-healing should have made anyone who thinks this over conclude that there must be something in the course of an illness which contributes to overcoming it. And this would have had to lead to further inquiries concerning the more hidden causes of illness. I have now tried to demonstrate how such karmic reasons for illness in human life might be found. I pointed out that what we do or feel in the normal course of life, whether good or bad, wise or unwise, right or wrong, does not really penetrate into the deeper layers of our organism. And I have told you why things which relate to our moral or intellectual judgment, or our feelings, remain at the surface, and are not subject to that law which we also discussed, which works into the deeper layers of our organism. As I have shown, there is a kind of barrier which prevents immorality from entering into the deeper forces of the human organism. What we do between birth and death is accompanied by the mental images or ideas we form in our consciousness, and this forms a defense against our deeds and thoughts interfering with the forces of our organism. The conscious mental images which accompany what we do or otherwise experience provide a protective barrier which prevents the results of our actions from affecting our organism. I also referred to the importance of experiences that have been forgotten and cannot be retrieved, experiences which we cannot recall to consciousness. Such experiences do penetrate into our inner organism in a certain way, and they can affect its formative forces, as the protective barrier formed by mental images is lacking in this case. And I also pointed to those forms of illness which are even closer to the surface, such as neurosis, neurasthenia, and so forth. A light is thrown upon, even upon, hysterical conditions. As we said, the cause of such conditions must be sought for in the ideas or mental images that have been forgotten, which have fallen out of the complex of consciousness and have sunk down into the inner soul life, where, as a sort of wedge, they assert themselves in the form of disease. We further pointed out the tremendous significance of the period which lies between birth and the time when we first begin to remember our experiences, and our attention was drawn to the fact that what at an earlier stage has been forgotten continues to be active within our living organism, forming, as it were, an alliance with the deeper forces of our organism, and thereby influencing our organism itself. As we see, a whole complex of mental images, a number of experiences, must sink down into the deeper foundations of our being before they can intervene in our organism. I then pointed out that this sinking down is most thorough when we have passed through the gate of death and are experiencing the further existence between death and a new birth. The quality of all experiences is then transformed into forces which now develop an organizing activity, and the feelings which we have experienced during the period between death and a new birth will become part of the formative forces that take part in the rebuilding of the body when we return to a new life. In these formative forces, man now carries within him the result of what, at an earlier stage, he held within his soul life, perhaps even in his conscious life of ideas. And further, we could point to the fact that man, with his conscious conceptions permeated by the capital I, oscillates between two influences present in the world, between the luciferic and the Ahrimanic influences. When, owing to the characteristics of our astral body, we have done wrong through violent emotions, temper, and so forth, we are driven thereto by luciferic forces. If such deeds then take the course we have just now described, if they are transformed into formative forces, they will be dwelling as causes of luciferic disease within the formative forces, and will lay the foundations of our new body. We have further seen that we are subject also to the Ahrimanic forces, which affect us more from outside. And, again, we had to admit, concerning the Ahrimanic forces, that they are transformed into formative forces, into forces shaping the newly built organism when man enters existence through birth. And in so far as the Ahrimanic influences mingle with the formative forces, so far as we may speak of are a monic predisposition to disease. We then pointed out in detail how the forces act that are developed in this way. I quoted some radical examples of this activity because in radical examples the picture is more distinct, more clearly defined. I gave the instance of a person who in his previous life had at all times acted in such a way as to produce a weak I consciousness and weak self-reliance, and whose I attached little value to itself, becoming absorbed only in generalities and so forth. Such a person will, after death, develop the tendency to absorb forces that will render him capable of strengthening and perfecting his I in the further incarnation. As a result of this, he will seek conditions that will give him an opportunity to fight against certain resistances, so that his weak I consciousness might be strengthened through resistance. Such a tendency will lead him to seek an opportunity to contract cholera, because in this he will face something that offers an opportunity to conquer those resistances, in the conquest of which he will be led in his next incarnation, or even should a cure be effected in the same incarnation, to a stronger I consciousness, or to forces which will, by way of self-education, lead him gradually to a stronger I consciousness. We have further stated that an illness such as malaria affords an opportunity to compensate for the overbearing I consciousness, which has been engendered by the soul in an earlier life through its deeds and emotions. Those of us who took part in our earlier anthroposophical studies will understand such a course of events. It has always been said that man's I finds its physical expression in his blood. Both of these illnesses, which have just been mentioned, are connected with blood and the laws of blood. They are so connected that in the case of cholera, there is a thickening of the blood, which can be regarded as the resistance which a weak self-reliance must experience, and by means of which it is trying to develop. We shall also be able to understand that in a case of malaria, we are faced with an impoverishment of the blood, and that an overdeveloped I consciousness needs the opportunity of being led to an impossible extreme. This impoverishment of the blood of an overdeveloped I will result in all efforts ending in annihilation. Naturally, these things are extremely intimately connected within the human organism. But if you examine them, you will soon find them comprehensible. From all of this, we understand the following. When we are dealing with an organism formed by a soul that has brought with it the tendency to overcome some imperfection in one or another direction, the person concerned will tend to become impregnated with a predisposition to a certain illness. But at the same time, he will have the capacity of fighting this illness, which is produced for no other reason than to provide the means of a cure. And a cure will be effected when the person, in accordance with his whole karma, acquires, through the conquest of the illness, such forces as will enable him, through the rest of his life, to make true progress by means of his work on the physical plane. In other words, if the stimulating forces are so strong that the individual concerned is able to acquire upon the physical plane itself those qualities on account of which the illness broke out, then he will be able to work with that reinforced power which he lacked before, and which he gained from the healing process. But if his overall karma is such that he did indeed intend to construct his organism so that through the conquest of the illness in question it should acquire forces which lead nearer to perfection, and yet because of the complexity of the causes was forced to leave his organism weak in another direction, then it may be that although the forces which are developed and applied in the healing process strengthen him, they do not do so sufficiently to make the individual concerned equal to his work upon the physical plane. In a case like this, the person, unable to use his newly acquired powers on the physical plane, will utilize them when he passes through the gate of death. He will attempt to supplement his powers by what he could not produce on the physical plane. At his next incarnation, these powers will be manifested in the configuration of his body. Bearing this in mind, one more indication should be given in relation to those forms of illness leading neither to a real cure nor to death, but to chronic conditions, to a kind of languishing state. It is extremely important indeed to understand what happens in the case of chronic illness. It may be the case that whatever healing could be effected with regard to the way in which the various bodies relate to one another has indeed been achieved. The illness has been overcome in a certain sense. But in another sense, it might not have been overcome. In other words, etheric and physical bodies may have been harmonized, while the imbalance between etheric body and astral body continues to exist. As a result, the individual in question oscillates between endeavoring to heal and not being able to heal. In a case like that, it is of the utmost importance for the affected individual to make the best possible use of whatever actual healing has already been achieved. Yet it is what happens least of all in reality, for it is precisely in the case of those illnesses that become chronic that we find ourselves in a vicious circle. If we were able in a case like that to isolate that part of our organism that has achieved a certain cure, if we could let it be, as it were, and withdraw from the healthy part the rest which is still in disturbance and disorder, which is usually rooted in the astral body, we would do ourselves a great favor. But many things oppose this, and chiefly the fact that when we have had an illness resulting in a chronic condition, we are living all the time under the influence of that condition. And if I may thus crudely express myself, we can never really completely forget our condition, never really arrive at a withdrawing of that which is not yet healthy, so as to treat it by itself. On the contrary, through thinking continually about the sickly part of our organism, we bring, as it were, our healthy part into some kind of relationship with the sickness and thus irritate it anew. This is a special process. And in order to make it clearer, I should like to explain the facts of the matter in terms of spiritual science and tell you what can be perceived clairvoyantly when a person has gone through an illness and has retained something which may be termed chronic. The same applies, by the way, when there is no apparent acute illness, but when a chronic disease is developed without any acute state having been specially noticed. In most of these cases, it is possible to see that there is an unstable state of balance between the etheric and the physical body, an oscillation of the forces which is not normal, but can be lived with. This oscillation of forces, which appertain to the etheric body and the physical body, bring about a continual state of irritation in the individual concerned, which leads to continuous states of agitation. Clairvoyant consciousness sees this agitation transmitted to the astral body, and these states of excitability continually force their way into that part of the organism which is partly ill and partly well, which results in instability as opposed to balance. These states of astral agitation result in a marked deterioration of the individual's general state of health, which would otherwise be far better. Please consider that in this context, the astral does not relate to the person's consciousness, but rather to inner states of soul agitation, of which the patient is not aware to the extent of being willing to admit to them. As the barrier provided by mental images is non-existent in such cases, these emotional states of upheaval, these continuous states of weariness and inner discontent, will not always work as conscious forces, but rather as the organizing or life forces. Seated within our deeper being, they continually irritate that part which is partly healthy and partly sick. If the patient, by means of a strong discipline of the soul, could forget his condition for some time, at least, he would gain such satisfaction from this, that even from this satisfaction itself he could derive the necessary strength to carry on further. If he could forget his state completely and develop the strong will to say, quote, "I will not bother with my condition now," close quote, and if he would then apply the soul forces released in that manner to something spiritual, they would elevate him and inwardly satisfy his soul. If he liberated the forces that are continuously occupied with the sensation of aches and pains, oppression, and so on, he would gain great satisfaction. For if we do not live through these feelings, the forces are free, and they are at our disposal. Naturally, it will not be of much use merely to say we don't want to take notice of these aches and pains. For if we do not put these liberated forces to spiritual use, the former conditions will soon return. If, however, we employ these liberated forces for a spiritual purpose, which will absorb the soul, we shall soon discover that we are attaining in a complicated way that which our organism would otherwise have attained without our assistance through the conquest of the illness. Naturally, the person in question would have to be careful not to fill his soul with something directly connected with his illness. For instance, if someone suffering from a weakness of the eyes were to read a great deal so as to avoid thinking of this, he would naturally not arrive at his goal. But it is quite unnecessary to resort to further illustrations. We have all noticed how useful it is, when we are slightly indisposed, to be able to forget that indisposition, especially if we gain this forgetfulness by occupying ourselves with something different. Such is a positive and wholesome forgetfulness. This already suggests to us that we are not entirely impotent in the face of the karmic effects of those transgressions of our earlier lives, which are expressed in the form of illness. After all, if we recognize that everything which is subject to moral, emotional, and intellectual judgment during our life between birth and death cannot penetrate so deeply during one single life as to become the cause of an organic disease, but that in the period between death and a new birth it may penetrate so deeply into the human essence as to cause disease, we must allow for the fact that it should be possible to re-transform these processes into conscious processes. The question might be put thus: if illnesses are the karmic results of spiritual or other events called forth or experienced by the soul, if they are the metamorphosis of such causes, is it not conceivable then, in fact is it not borne out by the spiritual facts, that the product of the metamorphosis, namely the illness, might be avoided? Might it not be avoided if we could substitute the process of healing, that which is drawn from the organs in the form of illness to educate us, with its spiritual counterpart, its spiritual equivalent? Should we not thus, if we were sufficiently wise, transform illness into a spiritual process, and accomplish through our soul forces the self-education that would otherwise be accomplished through illness? The feasibility of this may be demonstrated by an example. Here again we must insist that only those examples are given which have been investigated by spiritual science. They are not hypothetical assertions, but actual cases. A certain person contracts measles in later life, and we seek for the karmic connection in this case. We find that this case of measles appeared as the karmic effect of occurrences in a preceding life. Occurrences such as these: In a preceding life, the individuality in question disliked concerning himself with the external world, but occupied himself a great deal with himself, though not in the ordinary egotistical sense. He investigated much, meditated much, though not with regard to the facts of the external world, but with a strong concentration on his inner life of soul. We meet many people today, too, who believe that through self-concentration and through brooding within themselves, they will arrive at the solution of world riddles. The person in question sought to cope with his life by constantly pondering over how to conduct himself in different situations. The weakness of soul resulting from this led to the formation of forces during his existence between death and a new birth, which exposed his organism to an attack of measles comparatively late in life. We might now ask, quote, if on the one hand we have the attack of measles, which is the physical karmic effect of an earlier life, how is it then with the soul? Close quote. For the earlier life will also karmically produce a certain condition of the soul. The soul condition will prove itself to be such that the personality in question, during the life in which the attack of measles took place, was again and again subject to self-deception. Thus, in the self-deception, we must see the psychic karmic result of this earlier life, and the attack of measles, the physical karmic result. Let us now assume that this personality, before developing measles, had succeeded in gaining such soul forces that he was no longer exposed to all kinds of self-deception, having completely corrected this failing. In this case, the acquired soul force would have rendered the attack of measles quite unnecessary, since the tendencies brought forth in this organism during its formation had been effaced through the stronger soul forces acquired by self-education. Of course, I cannot talk to you ad infinitum about these things, but if you really examined what goes on in life around you and considered every single detail from the point of view I have just described, you would invariably find that outer facts bear out fully what I have related to you, to the minutest detail. And what I have said about a case of measles can lead to an explanation why measles is one of the illnesses of childhood. For the failings I have mentioned are present in a great many lives, and especially in certain periods they prevailed in many lives. When such a personality enters existence, he will be anxious to make the corresponding correction as soon as possible. In the period between birth and the general appearance of children's complaints, which effect an organic self-education, there can, as a rule, be no question of any education of the soul. From this we see that, in a certain respect, we can really speak of illness being transformed back into a spiritual process. And it is most significant that when this process has entered the soul as a life principle, it will evoke an inner disposition which has a healing effect upon the soul. We need not be surprised that in our time we are able to influence the soul so little. Anyone who is able to evaluate our present period from the standpoint of spiritual science will understand why so many medical people, so many doctors, become materialists. In other words, why they despair of any effects of the soul whatsoever. For most people never occupy themselves with anything which has vital force. All the stuff produced today is devoid of vital force for the soul. That is why anyone wishing to work for spiritual science feels in this anthroposophical activity something extremely wholesome, for spiritual science can, again, bring to mankind something which enters the soul so that it is drawn away from what was formed in the physical organism. But we must not confuse what appears at the beginning of such a movement as anthroposophy with what this movement can be in reality. After all, many of the misconceptions rampant in the world outside are brought right into the anthroposophical movement, because people, on becoming anthroposophists, often bring to anthroposophy exactly the same interests they have for other things, and also all the bad habits they have outside. In that way, much of the degeneracy of our age is brought in. Yet when some such degeneracy appears in the people in question, the world says that this is the effect of anthroposophy. That is, of course, a very cheap statement. I've shown you now how the karmic thread runs from one incarnation to the next. But this is only one aspect of the overall reality. If you develop a sense of how karma works from incarnation to incarnation, you will want to know a lot more. Many more aspects will be explored in the course of these lectures. But first of all, we must deal with the question, what difference is there between an illness due to external causes and an illness where the cause lies exclusively in the human organism itself? We are tempted to dispose of the latter illnesses by saying that they come of their own accord without any external provocation. But this is not so. In a certain sense, we are justified in saying that there are illnesses to which we are particularly prone on account of our inner organism. A great many forms of illness, however, we shall be able to trace to external causes. Not indeed everything that happens to us, but much that befalls us from outside. If we break a leg, for instance, we are obliged to account for it by external causes. We must also include, within external causes, the effects of the weather and numerous cases of disease caused by bad inner city housing. Here again we envisage a wide field. An experienced person looking on the world will find it easy to explain why the modern trend of the medical profession is to seek the causes of illness in external influences, and especially in germs. Of these a witty gentleman said, not without justification, quote, "Today it is said that illnesses are caused by germs, just as it was formerly said that they came from God, the devil, and so forth. In the 13th century it was said that illnesses came from God. In the 15th it was said that they came from the devil. Later it was said that illnesses came from the humors. Today we say that illnesses come from germs." Close quote. These are the views that superseded one another in the course of time. Thus we speak of external causes of human illness or health. In this context, modern man is easily tempted to employ a word that is eminently suited to confuse one's thinking about the way the world is arranged. When someone who previously enjoyed good health moves into an area where there is an epidemic of diphtheria or influenza and subsequently falls ill, modern man would certainly be inclined to say that the person concerned contracted the germs causing the illness as a result of moving into that area, and he will probably use the word chance in this context. There is a general tendency to speak of accidental influences or chance events. In actual fact, chance is a problematic term, whatever one's worldview may be. And as long as we don't even attempt to make clear in some way what actually is so conveniently referred to as chance, we cannot hope to advance to any reasonably satisfactory view of the world. This is the starting point of the theme, quote, "natural illnesses and accidental illnesses in human life," close quote. It is essential that we should first of all try to throw some light on the word chance. Is not chance itself something which ought to make us suspicious of the way it is generally conceived of today? I already referred on a previous occasion to what a certain educated gentleman in the 18th century said in relation to the custom of erecting monuments to great explorers, inventors, and such like. He said, not without justification, that most monuments by far ought to be erected to chance, if one really followed the course of history objectively. Is it not strange that if we take a closer look at historical development, we can make peculiar discoveries about what chance often conceals? As I have mentioned before, We owe the telescope to the fact that children were once playing with optical lenses in an optical laboratory. In their play, they formed a combination by means of which someone then produced a telescope. You might also recall the famous lamp in the Cathedral of Pisa, which before the time of Galileo was seen by thousands and thousands, oscillating with the same regularity. But it remained for Galileo to find out by experiment how these oscillations coincided with the course of his blood circulation, whereby he discovered the famous laws of the pendulum. Had we not known these, the whole of our culture would have received a very different coloring. Let us try to find a meaning in human evolution, and then see whether we should still wish to maintain that only chance was at work when Galileo made this important discovery. Let us consider yet another case. We are aware that Luther's translation of the Bible Luther's translation of the Bible means to the civilized countries of Europe. It profoundly influenced religious sentiment and thought, and also the development of what we call the German literary language. I simply mention the fact without comment. I insist only on the profound influence which this translation exercised. We must endeavor to see the significance of that education, which during the course of several centuries came to mankind as a result of Luther's translation of the Bible. Let us endeavor to perceive a meaning in this, and then let us consider the following fact. Up to a certain period of his life, Luther was deeply imbued with the feeling and desire so to order his life as to become a veritable, quote, child of God, close quote. This desire had been brought about by a constant reading of the Bible. The custom prevailed among the Augustinian monks of reading preferably the works of the fathers of the church. But Luther passed to the spiritual enjoyment of the Bible itself. Thus he was led to this intense feeling of being a child of God, and under this influence he fulfilled his duties as teacher of theology in the first Wittenberg period. The fact that I should now like to emphasize is that Luther had a certain reluctance to acquiring the title of Doctor of Theology. It was during a chance conversation with an old friend of the Erfurt Augustinian Monastery that he was persuaded to try for the doctorate. For this purpose he needed to resume and step up his studies of the Bible. Thus it was the chance conversation with his friend which led to a renewed study of the Bible and to all that resulted from it. Try to conceive, from the point of view of the last centuries, the significance of the, in quotes, chance that Luther once conversed with that friend and was persuaded to try for the doctorate in theology. You will be obliged to see that it would be grotesque to connect this human evolution with a chance event. From what has been said, we shall first of all conclude that perhaps, after all, there is something more in chance than is usually supposed. As a rule, we believe chance to be something which cannot be satisfactorily explained either by the laws of nature or the laws of life, and that it constitutes a kind of surplus over and above what can be explained. Let us now view this against the background of a fact which has helped us to understand so many aspects of life. Man, since he began his earth existence, has been subject to the two forces of the luciferic and Ahrimanic principles. These forces and principles continually penetrate into the human being. While the luciferic forces act more within by influencing our astral body, the Ahrimanic forces act, rather, through the external impressions which we receive. In what we receive from the external world, there are contained the Ahrimanic forces, and in what arises and acts within the soul, in the form of joy and dejection, desires, and so forth, there are contained the luciferic forces. The luciferic as well as the Ahrimanic principles induce us to give way to error. The luciferic principle induces us to deceive ourselves as to our own inner life, to judge our inner life wrongly, to see Maya, illusion, within ourselves. If we contemplate life rationally, we shall not find it difficult to discover Maya in our own soul life. Let us consider how very often we persuade ourselves that we have done one thing or another for this or that reason. Generally, the reason is quite a different one and far more profound. It may be found in temper, desire, or passion, but in our superficial consciousness, we give quite a different explanation. We try especially hard to deny things which are not generally approved of. And when we are driven to some act from purely egotistical motives, we frequently find ourselves clothing these crude egotistical impulses with a cloak of unselfishness and explaining why it was necessary for us to act in this way. However, normally we are not aware that we act like this. When we become aware of it, there generally begins an improvement accompanied by a certain feeling of shame. The worst of it is that for the most part we are ignorant of the fact that we are driven to something from the depths of our soul, and then we invent a motive for the deed in question. This has also been discovered by modern psychologists. Yet because today's education in psychology is so scanty, the materialist psychologists of our time come up with such grotesque misrepresentations of facts like the ones described. They arrive at very peculiar interpretations of life. If you apply the methods of spiritual research to such matters, you will naturally understand their true meaning and characterize the whole phenomenon as follows. There are indeed two influences acting together, namely our consciousness and that which dwells in the deeper layers beneath the threshold of consciousness. But when the same facts are observed by a materialistic psychologist, he will set to work differently. He will immediately fabricate a theory about the difference between the pretext we presume for our deeds and the real motive. If, for instance, a psychologist discusses the suicides of schoolchildren, which occur so frequently nowadays, he will say that what is quoted as pretext is not the real motive, that the real motive lies far deeper, being found mostly in a misdirected sexual life, and that the real motive is so transformed that it deludes the consciousness for some reason or other. Often this may be so, but anyone with the slightest insight into the true depths of psychology would never construct a comprehensive theory out of that. Such a theory could easily be refuted, for if the case really is such that pretext is nothing and motive everything, this would also apply to the psychologist himself, and we should be forced to say that with him, too, what he is telling us and developing as a theory is but a pretext. If we were to search for deeper reasons, perhaps the reasons alleged by him would be found to be of exactly the same nature. If such a psychologist had really fully grasped the impossibility of a judgment based on a conclusion such as, quote, all idiots are liars, close quote, and furthermore, that such a judgment is lopsided when uttered by an idiot, if he had really grasped the reason why this is so, he would have also learned what peculiar vicious circles are created when in certain fields assertions can be turned back on the one making them. Yet there is extraordinarily little real in-depth education in nearly all our literature. Hence people generally do not notice any more what they are doing. Therefore it will be essential for spiritual science to, in particular, to avoid such logical confusion in all respects. These logical confusions are least avoided by modern philosophers dealing with the science of the soul, and our example is a very typical one. It exemplifies the kinds of tricks luciferic forces play upon us, turning our entire soul life into Maya, so that we can deceive ourselves about the real motives for our deeds instead of recognizing what dwells within us. In this realm, it is important to acquire a stricter self-discipline. Today, words are, as a rule, handled with great facility. A word, however, can lead to a great error and confusion. The word has but to have a pleasing sound, and it creates the impression of a charitable deed. Even the pleasant sound of a sentence will betray us into believing that the motive in question is within our soul, while in truth the egotistical principle may be concealed behind it without our being aware of its presence, because we have not the will to arrive at true self-knowledge. Thus we see Lucifer active on the one side. How does Ahriman act on the other? Ahriman is that principle which intermingles with our perceptions and enters us from outside. Ahriman's activity is strongest when we feel, quote, thinking is not taking me any further. I have reached a critical point in my thinking. It is caught up in a great knot, close quote. Then the Ahrimanic principle seizes the occasion to penetrate us as through a rift in the external world. If we follow the course of world events and the more obvious occurrences, if, for instance, we pursue modern physics back to the moment when Galileo was sitting in front of the oscillating church lamp in the Cathedral of Pisa, we can spin a thought net embracing all these events, whereby the matter will be easily explained. Everything will be quite clear. But the moment we arrive at the oscillating church lamp, our thoughts become confused. That is the window through which the Ahrimanic forces penetrate us with the greatest strength. And that is where our thought refuses to grasp that very thing in the phenomena that can bring reason and understanding into the matter. Here is also what we call chance. It is here that Ahriman becomes most dangerous to us. The very phenomena we call chance are those by which we are most easily deluded by Ahriman. Thus we shall learn to understand that it is not the nature of facts themselves that induces us to speak of chance, but that it depends on ourselves and our own development. Little by little we shall have to educate ourselves to penetrate Maya and illusion. That is to say, we must gain insight into matters where Ahriman's influence is at its strongest, and especially in the context of major causes of illness, and the light that is to be shed over the course of many an illness, we will have to approach the phenomena from this point of view. First of all, we shall have to try and understand to what extent it is not a matter of chance that someone should be traveling on the very train on which he may lose his life, or that someone at a definite period should be exposed to disease germs affecting him from outside, or to some other cause of illness. Once we are capable of researching such matters with heightened understanding, we will grasp the real nature and significance of illness on an even deeper level. Today I had to show in somewhat greater detail how Lucifer leads to illusions within ourselves, and how Ahriman becomes intertwined with external perceptions, and there leads to Maya. That it is the work of Lucifer when we delude ourselves with a false motive, and how wrong conclusions in relation to the world of phenomena, Ahriman's deception, lead us to believe in chance. I had to give you this background before demonstrating the working of karma, of the results of an earlier life, in human life, even where seemingly accidental outer reasons bring about illness. The end of Lecture 5.